This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
If you've ever turned on a light, sent a text message, or watched TV with any device made in the last few years, you're using LED technology. Advances in LEDs are happening rapidly, and some of those breakthroughs are coming from unexpected corners.
It pushes technological frontiers, and it's not incremental. It's actually a substantial advance in the area of advanced lighting.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll meet a college student who invented a new type of LED and won a prestigious competition along the way. We'll also hear how schools need to be turning out more lab technicians than they are now, and spend an academic minute talking about lizard's tails. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Many of us are familiar with LED technology. LEDs, or light-emitting diodes, are used in applications as diverse as aviation lighting, automotive lighting, and traffic signals. LEDs have allowed new text, video displays, and sensors to be developed, while their high switching rates are also useful in advanced communications technology. The Best of Our Knowledge's Dave Lucas reports that a student at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute in Troy, New York, has been named the winner of a national competition for technological innovation for inventing a new kind of LED.
Ming Ma, a doctoral student in RPI's Department of Materials Science and Engineering, has been named the winner of the 2013 Lemelson Rensselaer Student Prize, which, along with prizes for students at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, is one of three $30,000 Lemelson MIT Collegiate Student Prizes awarded annually. Ma invented a new type of LED, graded refractive index, or GRIN. GRIN LEDs are brighter, more energy efficient, and have superior technical properties than those on the market today. Ma explains a bit about his patent-pending invention.
My invention is in the context of light sources. And in this specific case, the light source is light-emitting diodes, or LEDs. So there's one problem in the current LEDs, because there is reflection in the LED, so the light is confined in the LED. But actually, the modern nature has already showed us a solution to this problem. That is, if you look at the Earth's atmosphere, it has no reflection. And the reason is because it has this graded refractive index profile. So that is the reason why the Earth's atmosphere has no reflection. So my project is just to apply this concept to LEDs. And so the project is entitled Graded Refractive Index LEDs. So I put these structures on the LEDs so the LEDs have no internal reflection, so all the light can come out of the LEDs. And in addition, we can also achieve more uniform lighting thanks to these well-structured features.
What got you thinking along these lines that you were able to come up with this?
Basically, at the beginning, I just want to have to do some research that has impact on everybody's daily life. And I just realized that, you know, everybody needs lights every day. So my initial motivation is just to improve the efficiency of lights. Then I just try to see what's the problem, why LEDs cannot reach high efficiency. And then find out it is because of this internal reflection. Then this idea come from the Earth's atmosphere that showing a way that allows us to put this concept to LEDs to improve its efficiency. So it's just naturally come to the current project.
Ma is the seventh recipient of the Lemelson Rensselaer Student Prize, first given in 2007. It is awarded annually to a senior or graduate student at RPI who has created or improved a product or process, applied a technology in a new way, redesigned a system, or demonstrated remarkable inventiveness in other ways. RPI Dean of Engineering David Rosowski.
Ming's award-winning discovery it speaks for itself. It pushes technological frontiers, and it's not incremental. It's actually a substantial advance in the area of advanced lighting. We have a number of other student competition entrants this year that rose to the level of finalist. One of them is embedding a sensor that can be embedded on bones and in and around tissue when, say, a replacement joint is being put in surgically. And it can actually be used to detect the levels of stress in and around the bone without any active electronics inside the person. It's a passive device that is read by moving a device outside of the person to detect the level of stress in the bone. This is revolutionary because it's really a non-invasive sensor. It can be produced, I suspect, at very low cost, and it requires no power to serve as a sensor for surgeons and for rehabilitation specialists post-operatively. Another invention by Navid Atari has the potential to dissipate significant amounts of earthquake energy in bridge and building systems using really mechanical gears as a mechanism for dissipating energy. So it's also essentially passive in that it involves no additional energy to dissipate the earthquake energy and the earthquake forces in the bridges. These have the potential to revolutionize their field.
Rosowski details the process of how finalists are judged and how Ma was selected as winner of the competition.
We impanel a group of alumni from Rensselaer that includes scientists, engineers, and entrepreneurs and even venture capitalists. And they select the winner of the $30,000 Lemelson Rensselaer Student Prize. And what's great about this, besides engaging our alumni, is it offers opportunity for the finalists to meet not only with leading lights in science and engineering, but investors and venture capitalists and entrepreneurs who have taken products into businesses and created very successful enterprises, and in many cases can help these people launch their own successful businesses.
Ma grew up in Jiangxi Province in Southeast Asia and became interested in advanced materials as an undergraduate student at Fudan University in Shanghai, which inspired him to study LEDs as a graduate student at Rensselaer. Ma plans to stay in the United States after completing his education at RPI. The Lemelson MIT program was founded in 1994 by Jerome H. Lemelson, one of America's most prolific inventors, and his wife, Dorothy. Funded by the private philanthropy, the Lemelson Foundation, the program is administered by MIT's School of Engineering and supports projects in the U.S. and developing countries that nurture innovators to advance economic, social, and environmentally sustainable development. Reporting for The Best of Our Knowledge, I'm Dave Lucas.
As the population ages, our doctors are ordering more and more lab tests to screen for disease. So we need more and more labs and lab technicians to perform and read these tests. That said, laboratory directors are themselves an aging population, with some estimates suggesting that up to 50% of current laboratory directors in the U.S. will retire in the next 10 years. Questions have been raised about training the next generation of clinical laboratory directors and pathologists, especially in respect to how many to train and what areas of the field need to be emphasized. Here to talk about the possible coming shortage of lab technicians is Dr. Mitch Scott, the co-medical director of clinical chemistry and decentralized testing at Barnes Jewish Hospital and professor of pathology and immunology at Washington University in St. Louis. I spoke with Dr. Scott recently about the crop of aging clinical chemists and, well, how this actually became a problem.
Well, the simple answer is that both pathologists and clinical chemists, and really, for that matter, medical technologists, are an aging group of people. Some specific data that I can give you is that in 2005, the median age of pathologists in the College of American Pathologists was 55. Today, it's probably around 57, although I can't quote that like I can in 2005. And in 2005, AACC members had a median age of around 55. So, you know, if it's 55 to 57 today and everyone retires at the age of 65, which of course not everyone will do, but it means that half of the professionals in our field, pathologists and clinical chemists, are going to retire in 10 years. And we're not training nearly enough people to fill that void if that indeed is what happens. Now, how it came to be is actually a pretty interesting story. This goes all the way back to the early 1990s and President and Hillary Clinton's first attempt at healthcare reform. Not much came out of that attempt at healthcare reform from a legal perspective, but it really was the beginning of managed care and attempts to consolidate healthcare services, including the laboratory. And as part of that movement towards managed care and healthcare reform in the early 90s, HCFA, the Healthcare Finance Administration, which is now known as CMS, or Center for Medicare Services, commissioned a study to look at all postgraduate training in postgraduate medical education. And one of the conclusions from that study that was published in 1993 was that there were three times more pathologists than needed at that time. And as a result, Medicare, who pays all postgraduate residency slots, had a major cut in the number of funded pathology slots. In 1992, there were like 520 slots, and in 2000, there were only 330 funded slots. At the same time, medical students and graduate students going into fellowships really kind of disappeared. In fact, in 1998, there were only 125 U.S. medical school grads going into pathology, as opposed to about 250 in 1992. At our institution here in St. Louis at Washington University, in 2000, we had 200 applicants for our residency slot. This past year, we had almost 400. It's turned around, but because of the cut in training slots and the cut in interest in going into laboratory medicine in the 90s, has led to the demographics of this being a fairly old field. So what it means is we need to train more people, and it also means that those going into this field today are really in a good position, because combined with the demographics of the field and then the aging population of the country and Western Europe means more tests, more patients, and it's just an ideal time to enter the field. And this is not happening just in the U.S., Dr. Poblani in Italy said that he's having trouble recruiting people into laboratory medicine. And I've used a slide in the past from Australia that's entitled, "It's Pathology Week, but Where Are the Pathologists?" This is not just a U.S. field has gotten old. Hopefully that tells you a little bit about what you asked.
Mm-hmm. Well, several of the respondents in your piece talk about the explosion of diagnostic testing and how this will make experts in laboratory medicine even more valuable to clinicians and patients as consultants and experts in test selection and interpretation. Now, considering this explosion of knowledge, how do you and other training programs keep up to date?
It's not easy. I mean, you really have to make an effort at it. And I think an approach that we take, and I'm sure many other training programs, both at the residency and fellowship level take, is to have numerous seminars during the week. Most of these are actually given by our residents and fellows, people in training. And we have three or four required seminars a week for our trainees and that are also attended by faculty. And they really accomplish two things. It helps the residents and fellows learn how to give good focused talks, so there's an educational perspective to it. But it also keeps everyone up to date. It's hard to keep up with the literature, and by having residents and fellows and faculty, for that matter, give talks on recent studies, recent findings, it helps to keep everyone going. We also have frequent journal clubs at our resident fellow beeper reports. Whenever an unusual call from the clinician has received, or a disease that some of us on faculty may not have heard of, or a test we may not have heard of, we have the residents and fellows do a 5-minute PowerPoint just so that we all learn from it. Another thing that we do is we recruit folks from outside of our laboratory medicine division to give lectures on topics that we believe are going to be important in the future. For instance, I've recruited the director of our core proteomics facility to give a talk on targeted proteomics for biomarkers. We have some next-gen sequencing experts participating, teaching. We hire new faculty. Recently, we've hired several folks in informatics, which are going to be critical in the future of our field. So we've added a molecular diagnostics rotation. You just have to try to keep up.
Still to come, our conversation with Dr. Mitch Scott continues with a look at what is no longer being included in that lab training. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge.
Got any questions or comments about the best of our knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past shows again, you can find us online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. You can start your own archive with a CD copy of the program. Call toll-free 800-323-9262. Be sure to ask for the best of our knowledge, number 1174. This is the best of our knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Our guest today is Dr. Mitch Scott, co-medical director of clinical chemistry and decentralized testing at Barnes Jewish Hospital and professor of pathology and immunology at Washington University, both in St. Louis. He spoke about the new additions to their training programs for clinical chemists. So I asked if there were so many additions, what's being deleted?
Well, that's a great question and one that we involved in training here and at other institutions ask ourselves all the time. As you add new topics and add new rotations, such as in molecular diagnostics, to an already busy schedule for residents and fellows, you do need to look at removing some other topics or rotations or shortening them. And the dilemma comes in is what you can hardly stop teaching a clinical chemist basic topics like electrolytes, liver and cardiac and damage markers, or quality control. I mean, these are things that they're going to face every day. So you end up asking yourself, what do you remove from training? One of the things that we do is we try to follow trends in test ordering patterns and new technologies that replace older tests or make them obsolete. So for instance, our volume of amylase and lipase testing has decreased dramatically over the last 5 to 10 years, and this is really due to improvements in imaging technologies that are now used more often to accurately diagnose pancreatitis, and I've all but removed this topic from my teaching. Another approach is that we have increased the number of topics we cover in our training sessions, but we don't do them as many times per year, so that we may end up having the same number of teaching sessions. We just don't repeat them as frequently during the year. But it's always a challenge to figure out what to drop when you add new material.
Well, all of the respondents stated they believed research to be an important part of training residents and fellows to some extent. How do you feel, and could you define what's meant by research during laboratory medicine training?
Well, I believe that research is an absolutely essential part of training in lab medicine. Whether or not a clinical pathologist or a clinical chemist goes on to have a career with a large component of his time in research or doesn't, I believe that anybody practicing lab medicine worth their salt must read and keep abreast of the literature. And if you haven't participated in research, actually taken a project from conception to publication or answering the initial question or hypothesis, and it really doesn't matter whether it's basic or clinical. But if you haven't done it, I think it's harder to critically evaluate what you read or to be able to recognize a strong study versus a poor study. And if someone practicing lab medicine is going to be good at what they do and be valuable as a consultant, they've got to be able to keep up with the literature and recognize good versus poor studies. Because I often tell our new residents that you just got to get past the if it's published, it must be true syndrome. Let me give you a sports analogy that I can use to say why I believe research is important, even if you're not going to be doing a lot of research in your ultimate career. A good friend of mine is from South Africa, and he played rugby in his school years. He lives in the U.S. today, but he still watches rugby games constantly and knows what he's watching. Now, if I watch a rugby match, I can enjoy the action and the players hitting each other, and I understand the basic rules, how you score a try, but I have no idea what was a good play from a scrum or a bad one, nor do I understand the strategies the teams employ to score a try. It's fun to watch, but I don't quite frankly get it well. And the vice versa could be said for him and coming from South Africa in baseball, but the point is you got to play the game to fully get it. And that's why I believe research during training is just critical.
Well, finally, Doctor, let's look into the future. How will you and others be training residents and fellows in, say, 10 years from now?
I think most everyone in the field believes that there's going to be much more genetic testing, using that genetic testing to target therapies and treatment. I think now that the proteomic world has moved from sort of random discovery to more targeted discovery, I think we're going to see an increase in proteomic tests in the future. And just beginning to come into the picture are epigenetic markers, things that are beyond sequencing, beyond the proteins that may direct therapy or provide prognosis.
Dr. Mitch Scott is the co-medical director of clinical chemistry and decentralized testing at Barnes Jewish Hospital and professor of pathology and immunology at Washington University in St. Louis. You can see a question and answer session on this topic in the March 2012 issue of the journal Clinical Chemistry. Okay, there's really no smooth way to get into this segment, so we'll just dive right in. Lizard tails. That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Welcome to the Academic Minute. I'm Lynn Pascarella, president of Mount Holyoke College. For obvious reasons, biologists are intently studying animals that can regenerate lost body parts. But as Rebecca Fisher, associate professor of life sciences at the University of Arizona, reveals, many times a regenerated part is never quite the same.
Animal lizards are the Darwin's finches of the reptiles, with over 400 documented species. Living in the southeastern U.S. and around the Caribbean basin, animals occupy a diverse array of microhabitats in the forest canopy and adjacent grasslands. Animals are a model for adaptive radiation, with species invading new territory and evolving rapidly to exploit different habitats. This process has been most clearly documented in island animals, which exhibit correlations between specific body shapes, behaviors, and microhabitats. In addition to serving as a model for evolutionary biology, animals are also excellent animals for studies of regeneration. Like many other lizard species, animals are capable of self-amputating their tails to escape predators. A period of regeneration follows, eventually giving rise to a new tail. Building on the recent genome sequencing of the green animal, scientists are now poised to investigate the genes and mechanisms responsible for the regeneration of cartilage, muscle, tendon, and nervous tissue. We've assembled an interdisciplinary team of scientists in Arizona to analyze tail regeneration in the green animal and related species. While the green animal tail consists of interlocking bones and short muscle fibers, the regenerated tail houses a single cartilaginous rod with elongated muscles. As animals are capable of regenerating a wide array of tissues, such as spinal cord, muscle, and cartilage, studying these processes may lead to future therapies for spinal cord injuries and degenerative diseases such as arthritis.
That was Rebecca Fisher of the University of Arizona. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors on our website, academicminute.org.
Production support for the Academic Minute comes from Newman's Own Foundation in partnership with Mount Holyoke College. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Shartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.